through analysis of mitochondrial DNA. Beyond this, everything goes dark. The power of tracing this multitude of lineages to reveal the past is extraordinary. In my mind's eye, when I think of a genome, I view it not as a thing of the present, but as deeply rooted in time, a tapestry of threads consisting of lines of descent and DNA sequences copied from parent to child, winding back into the distant past. Tracing back, the threads wind themselves through ever more ancestors, providing information about population size and substructure in each generation. When an African-American person is said to have 80% West African and 20% European ancestry, for example, a statement is being made that about 500 years ago, prior to the population migrations and mixtures precipitated by European colonialism, 80% of the person's ancestral threads probably resided in West Africa, and the remainder probably lived in Europe. But such statements are like still frames in a movie, capturing one point in the past. An equally valid perspective is that 100,000 years ago, the vast majority of lineages of African-American ancestors, like those of everyone today, were in Africa. The story told by the multitudes in our genomes. In 2001, the human genome was sequenced for the first time, which means that the great majority of its chemical letters were read. About 70% of the sequence came from a single individual, an African American, but some came from other people. By 2006, companies began selling robots that reduced the cost of reading DNA letters by more than 10,000-fold, and soon by 100,000-fold, making it economical to map the genomes of many more people. It thus became possible to compare sequences, not just from a few isolated locations, such as mitochondrial DNA, but from the whole genome. That made it possible to reconstruct each person's tens of thousands of ancestral lines of descent. This revolutionized the study of the past. Scientists could gather orders of magnitude more data and test whether the history of our species suggested by the whole genome was the same as that told by mitochondrial DNA and the Y chromosome. A 2011 paper by Heng Li and Richard Durbin showed that the idea that a single person's genome contains information about a multitude of ancestors was not just a theoretical possibility, but a reality. To decipher the deep history of a population from a single person's DNA, Li and Durbin leveraged the fact that any single person actually carries not one, but two genomes, one from his or her father, and one from his or her mother. Thus, it is possible to count the number of mutations separating the genome a person receives from his or her mother, and the genome the person receives from his or her father, to determine when they shared a common ancestor at each location. By examining the range of dates when these ancestors lived, plotting the ages of 100,000 Adams and Eves, Li and Durbin established the size of the ancestral population at different times. In a small population, there is a substantial chance that two randomly chosen genome sequences derive from the same parent genome sequence, because the individuals who carry them share a parent. However, in a large population, the chance is far lower. Thus, the times in the past when the population size was low can be identified based on the periods in the past when a disproportionate fraction of lineages have evidence of sharing common ancestors. Walt Whitman in the poem Song of Myself wrote, "Do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes." Whitman could just as well have been talking about the Li and Durbin experiment and its demonstration that a whole population history is contained within a single person, as revealed by the multitude of ancestors whose histories are recorded within that person's genome. An unanticipated finding of the Li and Durbin study was its evidence that after the separation of non-African and African populations, there was an extended period in the shared history of non-Africans when populations were small, as reflected in evidence for many shared ancestors spread over tens of thousands of years. A shared bottleneck event among non-Africans when a small number of ancestors gave rise to a large number of descendants today, was not a new finding. But prior to Leon Durbin's work, there was no good information about the duration of this event, and it seemed plausible that it could have transpired over just a few generations. For example, a small band of people crossing the Sahara into North Africa, or from Africa into Asia. The Lee and Durbin evidence of an extended period of small population size was also hard to square with the idea of an unstoppable expansion of modern humans both within and outside Africa around 50,000 years ago. Our history may not be as simple as the story of a dominant group that was immediately successful wherever it went. How the whole genome perspective put an end to simple explanations. The newfound ability to take a whole genome view of human biology, made possible by leaps in technology in the last decades, has allowed reconstruction of population history in far more detail than had been previously possible. In doing so, it revealed that the simple picture from mitochondrial DNA and the just-so stories about one or a few changes propelling the later Stone Age and Upper Paleolithic transitions, when recognizably modern human behavior became widespread, as reflected in archaeological sites across Africa and Eurasia, are no longer tenable. In 2016, my colleagues and I used an adaptation of the Lee and Durbin method to compare populations from around the world to the earliest branching modern human lineage that has contributed a large proportion of the ancestry of a population living today, the one that contributed the lion's share of ancestry to the San hunter-gatherers of southern Africa. Our study, like most others, found that the separation had begun by around 200,000 years ago, and was mostly complete by more than 100,000 years ago. The evidence for this is that the density of mutations separating San genomes from non-San genomes is uniformly high, implying few shared ancestors between San and non-San in the last 100,000 years. Pygmy groups from Central African forests harbor ancestry that is arguably just as distinctive. The extremely ancient isolation of some pairs of human populations from each other conflicts with the idea that a single mutation essential to distinctively modern human behavior occurred shortly before the Upper Paleolithic and later Stone Age. A key change essential to modern human behavior in this time frame would be expected to be at high frequency in some human populations today, those that descend from the population in which the mutation occurred, and absent or very rare in others. But this seems hard to reconcile with the fact that all people today are capable of mastering conceptual language and innovating their culture in a way that is a hallmark of modern humans. A second problem with the notion of a genetic switch became apparent when we applied the Lee and Durbin method to search for places where all the genomes we analyzed shared a common ancestor in the period before the Upper Paleolithic and later Stone Age. At FOXP2, the gene that seemed the best candidate for a switch based on previous studies, we found that the common ancestor of everyone living today, that is, the person in whom modern humanity's shared copy of FOXP2 last occurred, lived more than 1 million years ago. Expanding our analysis to the whole genome, we could not find any location, apart from mitochondrial DNA and the Y chromosome, where all people living today share a common ancestor less than about 320,000 years ago. This is a far longer timescale than the one required by Klein's hypothesis. If Klein was right, it would be expected that there would be places in the genome, beyond mitochondrial DNA and the Y chromosome, where almost everyone shares a common ancestor within the last 100,000 years. But these do not, in fact, seem to exist. Our results do not completely rule out the hypothesis of a single, critical genetic change. There is a small fraction of the genome that contains complicated sequences that are difficult to study and that was not included in our survey. But the key change, if it exists, is running out of places to hide. The timescale of human genetic innovation and population differentiation is also far longer than mitochondrial DNA and other genetic data suggested prior to the genome revolution. If we are going to try to search the genome for clues to what makes modern humans distinctive, it is likely that we cannot look to explanations involving one or a few changes. The whole genome approaches that became possible after the technological revolution of the 2000s also soon made it clear that natural selection was not likely to take the simple form of changes in a small number of genes as Klein had imagined. When the first whole genome datasets were published, many geneticists, myself included, developed methods that scoured the genome for mutations that were affected by natural selection. We were searching for the low-hanging fruit, instances in which natural selection had operated strongly on a few mutations. Examples of such low-hanging fruit include the mutations allowing people to digest cow's milk into adulthood, or mutations that cause darkening or lightening of skin to adapt to local climates, or mutations that bequeath resistance to the infectious disease malaria. As a community, we have been successful in identifying selection on mutations like these because they have risen rapidly from low to high frequency, resulting in a large number of people today sharing a recent ancestor or striking differences in mutation frequency between two otherwise similar populations. Events like these leave great scars on patterns of genome variation that can be detected without too much trouble. Excitement about this bonanza was tempered by work led by Molly Przeworski, who studied the types of patterns that natural selection is likely to leave on the genome as a whole. A 2006 study by Przeworski and her colleagues showed that genome scans of present-day human genetic variation will miss most instances of natural selection because they simply will not have the statistical power needed to detect it, and that scans of this type will also have more power to detect some types of selection than others. A study she led in 2011 then showed that only a small fraction of evolution in humans has likely involved intense natural selection for advantageous mutations that had not previously been present in the population. Thus, intense and easily detectable episodes of natural selection, such as those that have facilitated the digestion of cow's milk into adulthood, are an exception. So what has been the dominant mode of natural selection in humans, if not selection on newly arising single mutation changes that then rocket up to high frequency? An important clue comes from the study of height. In 2010, medical geneticists analyzed the genomes of around 180,000 people with measured heights and found 180 independent genetic changes that are more common in shorter people. This means that these changes, or ones nearby on the genome, contribute directly to reduced height. In 2012, a second study showed that at the 180 changes, Southern Europeans tend to have the versions that reduce height, and that this pattern is so pronounced that the only possible explanation is natural selection, likely for increased height in Northern Europeans or decreased height in Southern Europeans since the two lineages separated. In 2015, an ancient DNA study led by Ian Mathiasen in my laboratory revealed more about this process. We assembled DNA data from the bones and teeth of 230 ancient Europeans and analyzed the data to suggest that these patterns reflected natural selection for mutations that decreased height in farmers in Southern Europe after 8,000 years ago, or increased height in ancestors of Northern Europeans who lived in the Eastern European steppe lands before 5,000 years ago. The advantages that accrued to shorter people in Southern Europe or to taller people in Far Eastern Europe must have increased the number of their surviving children, which had the effect of systematically changing the frequencies of these mutations until a new average height was achieved. Since the discoveries about height, other scientists have documented additional examples of natural selection on other complex human traits. A 2016 study analyzed the genomes of several thousand present-day Britons and found natural selection for increased height, blonder hair, bluer eyes, larger infant head size, larger female hip size, later growth spurt in males, and later age of puberty in females. These examples demonstrate that by leveraging the power of the whole genome to examine thousands of independent positions in the genome simultaneously, it is possible to get beyond the barrier that Molly Przeworski had identified, Przeworski's limit, by taking advantage of information that we now have about a large number of genetic variations at many locations in the genome that have similar biological effects. We have such information from genome-wide association studies, which since 2005 have collected data from more than 1 million people with a variety of measured traits, thereby identifying more than 10,000 individual mutations that occur at significantly elevated frequency in people with particular traits, including height. The value of genome-wide association studies for understanding human health and disease has been contentious, because the specific mutation changes that these studies have identified typically have such small effects that the results are hardly useful for predicting who gets a disease and who does not. But what is often overlooked is that genome-wide association studies have provided a powerful resource for investigating human evolutionary change over time. By testing whether the mutations identified by genome-wide association studies as affecting particular biological traits have all tended to shift in frequency in the same direction, we can obtain evidence of natural selection for specific biological traits. As genome-wide association studies proceed, they are beginning to investigate human variation in cognitive and behavioral traits, and studies like these, such as the ones for height, will make it possible to explore whether the shift to behavioral modernity among our ancestors was driven by natural selection. This means that there is new hope for providing genetic insight into the mystery that puzzled Klein. The great change in human behavior suggested by the archaeological records of the Upper Paleolithic and later Stone Age. But even if genetic changes, through coordinated natural selection on combinations of many mutations simultaneously, did enable new cognitive capacities, this is a very different scenario from Klein's idea of a genetic switch. Genetic changes in this scenario are not a creative force abruptly enabling modern human behavior, but instead are responsive to non-genetic pressures imposed from the outside. In this scenario, it is not the case that the human population was unable to adapt because no one carried a mutation that allows a biological capability not previously present. Instead, the genetic formula that may have been necessary to drive the striking advances in human behavior and capacities that occurred during the Upper Paleolithic and later Stone Ages is not particularly mysterious. The mutations necessary to facilitate modern human behavior were already in place, and many alternative combinations of these mutations could have increased in frequency together due to natural selection in response to changing needs imposed by the development of conceptual language or new environmental conditions. This, in turn, could have enabled further changes in lifestyle and innovation in a self-reinforcing cycle. Thus, even if it is true that increases in the frequency of mutations were important in allowing modern humans to match their biology to new conditions during the Upper Paleolithic and later Stone Age transition, what we now know about the nature of natural selection in humans and about the genetic encoding of many biological traits means it is unlikely that the first occurrence of these mutations triggered the great changes that followed. If we search for answers in a small number of mutations that arose shortly before the time of the Upper Paleolithic and later Stone Age transitions, we are unlikely to find satisfying explanations of who we are. How the genome can explain who we are. It was molecular biologists who first focused the power of the genome onto the study of human evolution. Perhaps because of their background and their track record of using reductionist approaches to solve great mysteries of life like the genetic code, molecular biologists were motivated by the hope that genetics would provide insights into the biological nature of how humans differ from other animals. Excitement about this prospect has also been shared by archaeologists and the public, But this research program, important as it is still at its very beginning, because the answer is not going to be simple. It is in the area of shedding light on human migrations, rather than in explaining human biology, that the genome revolution has already been a runaway success. In the last few years, the genome revolution, turbocharged by ancient DNA, has revealed that human populations are related to each other in ways that no one expected. The story that is emerging differs from the one we learned as children or from popular culture. It is full of surprises. Massive mixtures of differentiated populations, sweeping population replacements and expansions, and population divisions in prehistoric times that did not fall along the same lines as population differences that exist today. It is a story about how our interconnected human family was formed in myriad ways never imagined. 2. Encounters with Neanderthals. The meeting of Neanderthals and modern humans. Today, the particular subgroup of humans to which we belong, modern humans, is alone on our planet. We outcompeted or exterminated other humans, mostly during the period after around 50,000 years ago, when modern humans expanded throughout Eurasia, and when major movements of humans likely happened within Africa, too. Today, our closest living relatives are the African apes, the chimpanzees, bonobos, and gorillas, all incapable of making sophisticated tools or using conceptual language. But until around 40,000 years ago, the world was inhabited by multiple groups of archaic humans who differed from us physically but walked upright and shared many of our capabilities. The question that the archaeological record cannot answer, but the DNA record can, is how those archaic people were related to us. For no archaic group has the answer to this question seemed more urgent than for the Neanderthals. In Europe, after 400,000 years ago, the landscape was dominated by these large-bodied people, with brains slightly bigger on average than those of modern humans. The specimen that gave its name to Neanderthals was found in 1856 by miners in a limestone quarry in the Neander Valley. The German word for valley is tall, T-H-A-L, or T-A-L. For years, debate raged over whether these remains came from a deformed human, a human ancestor, or a human lineage that is extremely divergent from our own. Neanderthals became the first archaic humans to be recognized by science. In The Descent of Man, published in 1871, Charles Darwin argued that humans are like other animals, in that they are also the products of evolution. Although Darwin didn't himself appreciate their significance, Neanderthals were eventually acknowledged to be from a population more closely related to modern humans than to living apes, providing evidence for Darwin's theory that such populations must have existed in the past. Over the next century and a half, there were discoveries of many additional Neanderthal skeletons. These studies revealed that Neanderthals had evolved in Europe from even more archaic humans. In popular culture, they garnered a reputation as beastly, much more different from us than they in fact were. The primitive reputation of Neanderthals was fueled in large part by a slouched reconstruction of the Neanderthal skeleton from La Chapelle-Osson, France, made in 1911. But from all the evidence we have, before about 100,000 years ago, Neanderthals were, behaviorally, just as sophisticated as our own ancestors, anatomically, modern humans. Both Neanderthals and anatomically modern humans made stone tools using a technique that has become known as Levallois, which requires as much cognitive skill and dexterity as the Upper Paleolithic and later Stone Age toolmaking techniques that emerged among modern humans after around 50,000 years ago. In this technique, flakes are struck off carefully prepared rock cores that have little resemblance to the resulting tools, so that craftspeople must hold in their minds an image of what the finished tool will look like, and execute the complex steps by which the stone must be worked to achieve that goal. Other signs of the cognitive sophistication of Neanderthals include the evidence that they cared for their sick and elderly. An excavation at Shanidar Cave in Iraq has revealed 9 skeletons, all apparently deliberately buried, one of which was a half-blind elderly man with a withered arm, suggesting that the only way he could have survived is if friends and family had lovingly cared for him. The Neanderthals also had an appreciation of symbolism, as revealed by jewelry made of eagle talons found at Krapina Cave in Croatia, and dating to about 130,000 years ago, and stone circles built deep inside Brunicle Cave in France, and dating to around 180,000 years ago. Yet despite similarities between Neanderthals and modern humans, profound differences are evident. An article written in the 1950s claimed that a Neanderthal on the New York City subway would attract no attention, provided that he were bathed, shaved, and dressed in modern clothing. But in truth, his or her strangely projecting brow and impressively muscular body would be giveaways. Neanderthals were much more different from any human population today than present-day populations are from each other. The encounter of Neanderthals and modern humans has also captured the imagination of novelists. In William Golding's 1955 The Inheritors, a band of Neanderthals is killed by modern humans, who adopt a surviving Neanderthal child. In Jean Owl's 1980 The Clan of the Cave Bear, a modern human woman is brought up by Neanderthals, and the conceit of the book is a dramatization of what close interaction of these two sophisticated groups of humans, so alien to each other and yet so similar, might have been like. There is hard scientific evidence that modern humans and Neanderthals met. The most direct is from Western Europe, where Neanderthals disappeared around 39,000 years ago. The arrival of modern humans in Western Europe was at least a few thousand years earlier, as is evident at Fumane in southern Italy, where around 44,000 years ago, Neanderthal-type stone tools gave way to tools typical of modern humans. In southwestern Europe, tools typical of modern humans, made in a style called Chateauperronian, have been found amidst Neanderthal remains that date to between 44,000 and 39,000 years ago, suggesting that Neanderthals may have imitated modern human toolmaking, or that the two groups traded tools or materials. Not all archaeologists accept this interpretation, though, and there is ongoing debate about whether Chateauperronian artifacts were made by Neanderthals or by modern humans. Meetings between Neanderthals and modern humans took place not only in Europe, but almost certainly in the Near East as well. After around 70,000 years ago, a strong and successful Neanderthal population expanded from Europe into Central Asia, as far as the Altai Mountains, and into the Near East. The Near East had already been inhabited by modern humans, as attested by remains at Skull Cave on the Carmel Ridge in Israel and Hafsa Cave in the Lower Galilee, dating to between about 130,000 and 100,000 years ago. Later, Neanderthals moved into the region, with one skeleton at Kabara Cave on the Carmel Ridge, dating to between 60 and 48,000 years ago. Reversing the expectation we might have that modern humans displaced Neanderthals at every encounter, Neanderthals were advancing from their homeland, Europe, even as modern humans retreated. Sometime after 60,000 years ago, though, modern humans began to predominate in the Near East. Now the Neanderthals were losers in the encounter, and they went extinct not only in the Near East, but eventually elsewhere in Eurasia as well. So it was that in the Near East, there were at least two opportunities for encounters between Neanderthals and modern humans. When early modern humans first peopled the region before around 100,000 years ago, and established a population that met the expanding Neanderthals, and when modern humans returned and displaced the Neanderthals there sometime around 60 or 50,000 years ago. Did the two populations interbreed? Are the Neanderthals among the direct ancestors of any present-day humans? There is some skeletal evidence for hybridization, Eric Trinkaus identified remains such as those from Waza Cave in Romania that he argued were intermediate between modern humans and Neanderthals. However, shared skeletal features sometimes reflect adaptation to the same environmental pressures, not shared ancestry. This is why archaeological and skeletal records cannot determine the relatedness of Neanderthals to us. Studies of the genome can. Neanderthal DNA. Early on, scientists studying ancient DNA focused almost exclusively on mitochondrial DNA for two reasons. First, there are about 1,000 copies of mitochondrial DNA in each cell, compared to 2 copies of most of the rest of the genome, increasing the chance of successful extraction. Second, mitochondrial DNA is information dense. There are many more differences for a given number of DNA letters than in most other places in the genome, making it possible to obtain a more precise measurement of genetic separation time for every letter of DNA that is successfully analyzed. Mitochondrial data analysis confirmed that Neanderthals shared maternal line ancestors with modern humans more recently than previously thought. The best current estimate is 470,000 to 360,000 years ago. Mitochondrial DNA analysis also confirmed that the Neanderthals were highly distinctive. Their DNA type was outside the range of present-day variation in humans, sharing a common ancestor with us at a date several times more ancient than the time when mitochondrial Eve lived. Neanderthal mitochondrial DNA provided no support for the theory that Neanderthals and modern humans interbred when they encountered each other. But at the same time, the mitochondrial DNA evidence could not exclude up to around a 25% contribution of Neanderthals to the DNA of present-day non-Africans. There is a reason why we have so little power to make statements about the Neanderthal contribution to modern humans, based only on mitochondrial DNA. Even if modern humans outside Africa today do have substantial Neanderthal ancestry, there are only one or a few women who lived at that time and were lucky enough to pass down their mitochondrial DNA to present-day people. And if most of those women were modern humans, the patterns we see today would not be surprising. So the mitochondrial data were not conclusive. But nevertheless, the view that Neanderthals and modern humans did not mix remained the scientific orthodoxy until Svante Paabo's team extracted DNA from the whole genome of a Neanderthal, making it possible to examine the history of all its ancestors, not just the exclusively maternal line. The advance to sequencing the whole Neanderthal genome was made possible by a huge leap in the efficiency of the technology for studying ancient DNA in the decade after the sequencing of Neanderthal mitochondrial DNA. The mainstay of ancient DNA research prior to 2010 was a technique called polymerase chain reaction, PCR. This involves selecting a stretch of DNA to be targeted, and then synthesizing approximately 20-letter-long fragments of DNA that match the genome on each side of the targeted segment. These unique fragments pick out the targeted part of the genome, which is then duplicated many times over by enzymes. The effect is to take a tiny fraction of all the DNA in the sample and make it the dominant sequence. This method throws away the vast majority of DNA, the part that is not targeted. Nevertheless, it can extract at least some DNA that is of interest. The new approach for extracting ancient DNA was radically different. It relied on sequencing all of the DNA in the sample, regardless of the part of the genome it comes from, and without pre-selecting the DNA based on targeting sequences. It took advantage of the brute power of new machines, which from 2006 to 2010 reduced the cost of sequencing by at least about 10,000-fold. The data could be analyzed by a computer to piece together most of a genome, or alternatively to pick out a gene of interest. To make the new approach work, Paabo's team needed to overcome several challenges. First, they needed to find a bone from which they could extract enough DNA. Anthropologists often work with fossils, bones completely mineralized into rocks. But it is impossible to get any DNA from a true fossil. Pabo was therefore looking for bones that were not completely mineralized, but contained organic material, including stretches of well-preserved DNA. Second, supposing the team could find a golden sample with well-preserved DNA, they still had to overcome the problem of contamination of the sample by microbial DNA, which comes from the bacteria and fungi that embed themselves in bone after an individual's death. These contribute the overwhelming majority of DNA in most ancient samples. Finally, the team had to consider the likelihood of contamination by the researchers, archaeologists or molecular biologists who handled the samples and chemicals and may have left traces of their own DNA on them. Contamination is a huge danger for studies of ancient human DNA. Contaminated sequences can mislead analysts because the modern humans handling the bone are related, even if very distantly, to the individual being sequenced. A typical Neanderthal ancient DNA fragment from a well-preserved sample is only about 40 letters long, while the rate of differences between modern humans and Neanderthals is about 1 per 600 letters. So it is sometimes impossible to tell whether a particular stretch of DNA comes from the bone or from someone who handled it. Contamination has bedeviled ancient DNA researchers time and again. For example, in 2006, Pabo's group sequenced about 1 million letters of DNA from Neanderthals as a trial run prior to a whole genome sequencing. A high fraction of the sequences were modern human contaminants, compromising interpretation of the data. Modern measures to minimize the possibility of contamination in ancient DNA analysis, which had already begun to be implemented in the 2006 study, and which became even more elaborate afterward, involve an obsessive set of precautions. For the 2010 study in which Pabo and his team successfully sequenced an uncontaminated Neanderthal genome, they took each of the bones they screened into a clean room, which they adapted from the blueprints of the clean spaces used in microchip fabrication facilities in the computer industry. There was an overhead ultraviolet, UV light, of the same type used in surgical operating suites that was turned on whenever researchers were not present, in order to convert contaminating DNA into a form that cannot be sequenced. The light also destroys ancient DNA on the outside of samples, but researchers drill beneath the surface and so are able to access DNA that is not destroyed. The air was ultra-filtered to remove tiny dust particles, anything more than 1,000 times smaller than the width of a human hair that might contain DNA. The suite was pressurized so that air flowed from inside to outside to protect the samples from any contaminating DNA wafting in from outside the lab. There were three separate rooms in the suite. In the first, the researchers donned full-body clean suits, gloves, and face masks. In the second, they placed the bones chosen for sampling into a chamber, where they were exposed to high-energy UV radiation, again with the goal of converting the contaminating DNA that might be lying on the surface into a form that cannot be sequenced. The researchers then cored the bones using a sterilized dental drill, collected tens or hundreds of milligrams of powder onto UV-irradiated aluminum foil, and deposited this powder into a UV-irradiated tube. In the third chamber, they immersed the powder into chemical solutions that removed bone minerals and protein, and ran the solution over pure sand, silicon dioxide, which under the right conditions binds the DNA, while removing the compounds that poison the chemical reactions used for sequencing. The researchers then transformed the resulting DNA fragments into a form that could be sequenced. First, they chemically removed the ragged ends of the DNA fragments that had been degraded after tens of thousands of years buried under the ground, in an extra measure to remove contamination beyond what had been done in the 2006 study. Pabo and his team attached an artificially synthesized sequence of letters, a chemical barcode, to the ends of the DNA fragments. Any contaminating sequences that entered the experiment after the attachment of the barcode could thus be distinguished from the DNA of the ancient sample. The final step was to attach molecular adapters at either end that allowed the DNA fragment to be sequenced in one of the new machines that had made sequencing tens of thousands of times cheaper than the previous technology. The best preserved Neanderthal samples turned out to be three approximately 40,000-year-old arm and leg bones from Vindija Cave in the highlands of Croatia. After sequencing from these bones, Pagbo's team found that the great majority of DNA fragments they obtained were from bacteria and fungi that had colonized the bones. But by comparing the millions of fragments to the present-day human and chimpanzee genome sequences, they found gold amidst the dross. These reference genomes were like the picture on a jigsaw puzzle box, providing the key to aligning the tiny fragments of DNA they had sequenced. The bones contained as much as 4% archaic human DNA. Once Pagbo realized in 2007 that he would be able to sequence almost the entire Neanderthal genome, he assembled an international team of experts with the goal of ensuring that the analysis would do justice to the data. This is how I got involved, together with my chief scientific partner, the applied mathematician Nick Patterson. Pagbo reached out to us because over the previous 5 years, we had established ourselves as innovators in the area of studying population mixture. Over the course of many trips to Germany, I played an important role in the analyses that proved interbreeding between Neanderthals and some modern humans. Affinities between Neanderthals and non-Africans. The Neanderthal genome sequences we were working with were unfortunately full of errors. We could see as much because the data suggested that several times more mutations had occurred on the Neanderthal lineage than on the modern human lineage after the two sequences separated from their common ancestors. Most of these apparent mutations could not be real, since mutations occur at an approximately constant rate over time. And as the Neanderthal bones were ancient, they were actually closer in time to the common ancestor than our present-day human genomes, and so should have accumulated fewer mutations. Based on the degree of excess mutations on the Neanderthal lineage, we estimated that the Neanderthal sequences we were working with had a mistake approximately every 200 DNA letters. While this might sound small, it is actually much higher than the rate of true differences between Neanderthals and present-day humans. So most of the differences we found between the Neanderthal sequence and present-day human sequences were errors created by the measurement process and not genuine differences between the Neanderthal and present-day human genomes. To deal with the problem, we restricted our study to positions in the genome that are known to be variable among present-day humans. At these positions, an error rate of about 0.5% was too low to confuse the interpretation. Based on these positions, we designed a mathematical test for measuring whether Neanderthals were more closely related to some present-day humans than to others. The test we developed is now called the Four Population Test, and it has become a workhorse for comparing populations. The test takes as its input the DNA letters seen at the same position in four genomes. For example, two modern human genomes, the Neanderthal, and a chimpanzee. It examines whether, at positions where there is a mutation distinguishing the two modern human genomes that is also observed in the Neanderthal genome, which must reflect a mutation that occurred prior to the final separation of Neanderthals and modern humans. The Neanderthal matches the second human population at a different rate from the first. If the two modern humans descend from a common ancestral population that separated earlier from the ancestors of Neanderthals, there is no reason why the mutation is more likely to have been passed down one modern human line than another, and thus the rate of matching of each of the two modern human genomes to Neanderthal is expected to be equal. In contrast, if Neanderthals and some modern humans interbred, the modern human population descended from the interbreeding will share more mutations with Neanderthals. When we tested diverse present-day human populations, we found Neanderthals to be about equally close to Europeans, East Asians, and New Guineans, but closer to all non-Africans than to all sub-Saharan Africans, including populations as different as West Africans and San hunter-gatherers from Southern Africa. The difference was slight, but the probability of these findings happening by chance was less than 1 in a quadrillion. We reached this conclusion, however, we analyzed the data. This was the pattern that would be expected if Neanderthals had interbred with the ancestors of non-Africans, but not Africans. Trying to make the evidence go away. We were skeptical about this conclusion because it went against the scientific consensus of the time, a consensus that had been strongly impressed on many members of our team. Pabo had done his postdoctoral training in the laboratory that, in 1987, had discovered that the most deeply splitting human mitochondrial DNA lineages are found today in Africa, providing strong evidence in favor of an African origin for all modern humans. Pabo's own 1997 work strengthened the evidence for a purely African origin by showing that Neanderthal mitochondrial DNA fell far outside all modern human variation. I too came into the Neanderthal Genome Project with a strong bias against the possibility of Neanderthal interbreeding with modern humans. My PhD supervisor, David Goldstein, was a student of Luca Cavalli-Sforza, who had made a fully out-of-Africa model a centerpiece of his models of human evolution, and I was steeped in this paradigm. The genetic data I knew about supported the out-of-Africa picture so consistently that, from my perspective, the strictest possible version of the out-of-Africa hypothesis, in which there was no interbreeding between the ancestors of present-day humans and Neanderthals, seemed like a good bet. Coming from this background, we were deeply suspicious of the evidence we were finding for interbreeding with Neanderthals, and so we applied a particularly stringent series of tests in order to find some problem with our evidence. We tested whether the result was dependent on the genome sequencing technology that we used, but we obtained the same result from two very different technologies. We considered the possibility that the finding might be an artifact of a high rate of error in ancient DNA, which is known to affect particular DNA letters much more than others. However, we obtained the same result regardless of the type of mutation we analyzed. We wondered if our finding resulted from the contamination of the Neanderthal sample by present-day humans. This could perhaps have tainted the data, despite the measures that Pabo's team had taken to guard against it in the lab, and despite the tests we had performed on the data to measure the degree of modern human contamination, which had suggested that any contamination that was present was too small to produce the patterns we observed. However, even if there had been contamination from present-day humans, the patterns we observed looked nothing like what would be expected from it. If there had been contamination, it would most likely have come from a European, since almost all the Neanderthal bones we analyzed were excavated and handled by Europeans. Yet, the Neanderthal sequence we had was no closer to Europeans than to East Asians or to New Guineans. Three very different populations. We remained skeptical, wondering if something we had not thought of could explain the patterns. Then in June 2009, I attended a conference at the University of Michigan, where I met Rasmus Nielsen, who had been scanning through the genomes of diverse humans from around the world. In most parts of the genome, Africans are more genetically diverse than non-Africans, and carry the most deeply diverging lineages, as is the case with mitochondrial DNA. But Nielsen was identifying rare places in the genome where the genetic diversity among non-Africans was greater than in Africans because of lineages that split off the tree of present-day human sequences early and were present only in non-Africans. These sequences just might be derived from archaic humans who had interbred with non-Africans. Nielsen joined our collaboration and compared the regions he and his colleagues identified to the data. When he compared 12 of his special regions to the Neanderthal genome sequence, he found that in 10 of them, there was a close match to the Neanderthal. This was far too high a fraction to happen by chance, most of Nielsen's highly divergent bits of DNA had to be Neanderthal in origin. Next, we obtained a date for when the Neanderthal-related genetic material entered the ancestors of non-Africans. To do this, we took advantage of recombination, the process that occurs during the production of a person's sperm or eggs that swaps large segments of parental DNA to produce novel spliced chromosomes that are passed to the offspring. For example, consider a woman who is a first-generation mixture of a Neanderthal mother and a modern human father. In her cells, each pair of her chromosomes consists of one unbroken Neanderthal chromosome and one unbroken modern human chromosome. However, her eggs contain 23 mixed chromosomes. One chromosome in an egg of hers might have its first half of Neanderthal origin and its other half of modern human origin. Suppose she mates with a modern human, and mixture continues down the generations with more modern humans. Over the generations, the segments of Neanderthal DNA get chopped into smaller and smaller bits, with recombination operating like the whirring blade of a food processor, splicing the parental DNA at random positions along the chromosome in each generation. By measuring the typical sizes of the stretches of Neanderthal-related DNA in present humans, evident from the size of sequences that match the Neanderthal genome more than they do sub-Saharan African genomes, we can learn how many generations have passed since the Neanderthal DNA entered a modern person's ancestors. With this approach, we found that at least some Neanderthal-related genetic material came into the ancestors of present-day non-Africans 86,000 to 37,000 years ago. We have since refined this date by analyzing ancient DNA from a modern human from Siberia who, radiocarbon dating studies show, lived around 45,000 years ago. The stretches of Neanderthal-derived DNA in this individual are on average 7 times larger than the stretches of Neanderthal-derived DNA in modern humans today, confirming that he lived much closer to the time of Neanderthal mixture. His proximity in time to the mixing event makes it possible to obtain a more accurate date of 54,000 to 49,000 years ago. But in 2012, we hadn't yet proven that the interbreeding we had detected was with Neanderthals themselves. The most serious questioning came from Graham Koop, who was convinced that we had detected interbreeding with archaic humans, but pointed out that it was possible that the interbreeding hadn't actually been with Neanderthals. Instead, the patterns could be the result of interbreeding with an as yet unknown archaic human, in turn distantly related to Neanderthals. A year later, we were able to rule out Koop's scenario after Pabo's laboratory sequenced a high-quality Neanderthal genome from a toe bone found in southern Siberia, dating to at least 50,000 years ago. If a sample is older than about 50,000 years, radiocarbon dating can only provide a minimum date, so it actually could be substantially older. For this genome, we were able to gather about 40 times more data than from the Croatian Neanderthal. With so much data, we could cross-check the sequence and edit away the errors. The resulting sequence was freer of errors than most genomes that are generated from living humans. The high-quality sequence allowed us to determine how closely related modern humans and Neanderthals are to each other, based on the number of mutations that have occurred on the lineages since they separated. We found few or no segments where the Siberian Neanderthal shared common ancestors with present-day sub-Saharan Africans within the last 500,000 years. However, there were shared segments with non-Africans roughly within the past 100,000 years. These dates fell within the time frame when Neanderthals were fully established in West Eurasia. This meant that the interbreeding was with true Neanderthals, not some distantly related groups. Mixing in the Near East. So how much Neanderthal ancestry do people outside of Africa carry today? We found that non-African genomes today are around 1.5 to 2.1% Neanderthal in origin, with the higher numbers in East Asians and the lower numbers in Europeans, despite the fact that Europe was the homeland of the Neanderthals. We now know that at least part of the explanation is dilution. Ancient DNA from Europeans who lived before 9,000 years ago shows that pre-farming Europeans had just as much Neanderthal ancestry as East Asians do today. The reduction in Neanderthal ancestry in present-day Europeans is due to the fact that they harbor some of their ancestry from a group of people who separated from all other non-Africans prior to the mixture with Neanderthals. The story of this early splitting group revealed by ancient DNA is told in part two of this book. The spread of farmers with this inheritance diluted the Neanderthal ancestry in Europe, but not in East Asia. Based on archaeological evidence alone, it would seem a natural guess that Neanderthals interbred with modern humans in Europe, the place where Neanderthals originated. But is that the place where the main interbreeding that left its mark in people today occurred? The genetic data cannot tell us for sure. Genetic data can show how people are related, but humans are capable of migrating thousands of kilometers in a lifetime even on foot, so genetic patterns need not reflect events that occurred near the locations where the people who carry the DNA live. If the ancient DNA studies of the last few years have shown anything clearly, it is that the geographic distribution of people living today is often misleading about their dwelling places of their ancestors. However, we can make plausible conjectures about geographic origin. Evidence of interbreeding is detected today not just in Europeans, but also in East Asians and New Guineans. Europe is a cul-de-sac of sorts within Eurasia, and would not have been a likely detour for modern humans expanding eastward. So where could Neanderthals and modern humans have met and mixed to give rise to a population that expanded not only to Europe, but also to East Asia and New Guinea? Archaeologists have shown how in the Near East, Neanderthals and modern humans traded places as the dominant human population at least twice between 130,000 and 50,000 years ago, and it is reasonable to guess that they might have met during this period. So interbreeding in the Near East provides a plausible explanation for the Neanderthal ancestry that is shared by Europeans and East Asians. Did interbreeding happen in Europe at all? In 2014, Pabo's group sequenced DNA from a skeleton from Waza Cave in Romania, the same skeleton that Eric Trinkaus had interpreted as a hybrid of Neanderthals with modern humans, based on features of its skull that were similar to both. Our analysis of the data showed that the Waza individual, who radiocarbon dating studies had shown lived about 40,000 years ago, had around 6-9% Neanderthal ancestry, far more than the approximately 2% that we measure in present-day non-Africans. Some stretches of Neanderthal DNA extend a third of the length of his chromosomes, a span so large and unbroken by recombination that we can be sure that the Waza individual had an actual Neanderthal no more than 6 generations back in his family tree. Contamination cannot explain these findings, as it would dilute the Neanderthal ancestry in the Waza individual, not increase it. It would also generate random matching to Neanderthals throughout the genome, not large stretches of Neanderthal DNA that could be readily identified by eye when we simply plotted along the genome the positions of mutations that match the Neanderthal genome sequence more closely than they match modern humans. This evidence of Neanderthal interbreeding didn't need statistics. The proof was in the picture. The discoveries about the interbreeding in the recent family tree of the Waza individual suggested that modern humans and Neanderthals also hybridized in Europe, the homeland of the Neanderthals. But the population of which Waza was a part, and which carried this clear imprint of interbreeding with European Neanderthals, may not have left any descendants among people living today. When we analyzed the genome of Waza, we found no evidence that he was more closely related to Europeans than to East Asians. This means that he had to have been part of a population that was an evolutionary dead end. a pioneer modern human population that arrived early in Europe, flourished there briefly, and interbred with local Neanderthals, and then went extinct. Thus, while the Waza individual provides powerful evidence that